Welcome to another episode of the Middle West Podcast. I'm your host, Taqib Musa. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Peace be upon you to all of our listeners. I'm joined today by my co-host, Hamda Muhammad.
Assalamu alaikum. Wa alaikum assalam.
And we're joined today to talk to us about our topic for today and about probably many other things. Is our guest joining us from Yorkshire. Yahya Burt is a writer, academic, previously a lecturer at the University of Leeds, and he's been involved in the UK community activism scene since the 90s. He's written extensively on subjects such as the UK's counterterrorism strategy, prevent, and the contributions of Muslims in the UK historically. And I happen to be in a WhatsApp group with him, and he's an avid WhatsApper as well on many discussions, which is actually how I approached him. So, Yahya, thank you very much for joining us. Really appreciate your time. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh to you and to your listeners.
Yeah, so welcome to the Middle West Podcast. I wanted to start off. We usually start with our guests' background before we get into the meat of the subject. So one of my questions was, looking at your profile, you have a very kind of famous father, and then you've been involved in various types of activism. You've been involved a little bit in the US, a little bit in the UK. So can you tell us a little bit about your background, how you came to be so active, and kind of what motivated you to go after subjects such as history of Muslims in the UK, and then prevent and to write so extensively on things like this?
I became a Muslim in 1989. And the first 3-4 years, I wasn't involved in any sort of political activism or campus activism. I was still learning the religion, really. Then I went to do a degree at SOAS. I got involved with the ISOC there, and got involved to the student scene there. Thereafter, when I really got involved was when I got politicized, if you like, really properly, was after 9/11. I decided that, you know, after seeing the Twin Towers, what happened, I thought we have to get involved. There's going to be a reaction to this. So I got involved with campaigning against Islamophobia. I was helping out the Muslim Council of Britain at the time. After that, I got involved in Islamic editing and publishing, journalism. I did policy work in London, representing the Muslim community on different issues, counterterrorism and community building. And I guess I was involved in that for about 10 years, on and off.
What sort of policy work?
Our generation, we were often improvising the way in which we would tackle issues after 9/11 because we didn't necessarily have all the institutions set up in advance to deal with it. So a lot of us are coming from different areas of life to work together on things like Islamophobia in the press or, you know, the anti-war movement or, you know, the things like the consultations with the government at the time, which was the Labour Party. So there was a whole host of issues, and a number of us, including myself, were involved in different levels with this sort of policy scene. Then I moved away from it really after about 2010 when the coalition government came in. I became more interested in the last 10 years in sort of recovering the kind of history of Muslim activism in Britain going back to the late 19th century. My academic research was focused on that period, but also the 1960s when student activism in Muslim student activism in Britain became nationally organized at a larger scale.
I guess those are the two kind of main, in the 19th century, you're talking about mostly British people like Abdullah Quilliam, or people who were probably from maybe the Indian subcontinent as part of the British Empire. And then in the 60s is the first wave of migration.
Yeah, I mean, there's a parallel in the sense that you had people coming from the Muslim world to study in London and in other universities, you know, to take law like you, Hamda, or you know, or do various things, and they would become politically active. So you had the first registered Islamic society that we're aware of was in 1886 in London.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and was becoming active in sort of anti-imperial struggles.
Was it SOAS by any chance? Because SOAS, where I think you went to, is like the gold standard of Muslimized.
SOAS wasn't established until I think it was just after the war, if I'm not mistaken. I might get shot down for that, but sometime in the early 20th century it was set up. So that's before SOAS days. But, you know, you basically had Indian activists were the most important component in London. But they were joined by, they saw themselves as mediating between, if you like, the British imperial interests and the Ottomans. Because they thought that what was most important is that at that time, this is before they were out and out calling for independence, that the British should be friendly to the Ottomans. Basically, so in this sort of late 19th century, that was the focus, and trying to encourage cordial relations, basically. And in Liverpool, where Abdullah Quilliam converts to Islam, he basically has the same approach, which they can somehow work within imperial structures to kind of see peace or amity between the British and the Ottomans and other Muslim states. Obviously, as you'll know. As through the course of the early 20th century, much of the Middle East is colonized. And so that kind of late 19th century position becomes untenable. And so the activism, the tone of the activism really changes through the First World War. It becomes more radicalized, if you like, more oppositional, and particularly going into the 1920s. But the kind of what was called pan-Islamism, a kind of... pan-Islamism in the late 19th century, a kind of unity of Muslim peoples. There were different strands within it. So some were saying, let's support the Ottomans, let's support the caliphate. Others were saying, we have to take up national causes, maybe have stronger national governance. Okay. So in Egypt, for instance, you had an increasing kind of nationalist strand, okay, amongst the early Salafia in the late 19th century in Egypt, okay. Then at the same time, you had these different strands push and pull, and the converts come in. The convert communities that emerge in two places. One is in Liverpool in the late 19th century, and the other place is in Woking in the early 20th century. Those were two early mosque communities that had a big focus on dawah, on converting people to Islam. You know, more than perhaps we're familiar with today.
Yeah.
And they were linked together with these other groups. And also you had working class Muslims who had come from all over the empire, who had been employed on the ships. And so you had small port communities emerging of what were known as Lascars. That was a kind of umbrella term for quote unquote Oriental sailors, but they could come from many parts of the Muslim world, Bengal.
Is that like Lashkar? Like
Lashkar, yeah. It comes from Al-Askari, you know, originally from soldier, okay? But it was a kind of, if you like, bolderized into Lashkar in English. So you had people coming from Somaliland, from Egypt, from Bengal, okay, from Bengal, from Gujarat, from Morocco. So all the places where the British imperial trade went, okay, they would pick people up and employ them as sailors, and they'd be dumped on the docks in London or South Shields or Liverpool, okay, without a job. And so there'd be a floating community emerging on these docks. And so the first informal prayer rooms, you know, the first communities mostly of men. And so Abdullah Quilliam, who converts to Islam in 1887 or declares his conversion in 1887, you know, he and his community worked with the Lascars. They fought for Lascar rights, you know, fair wages and all this kind of stuff. You know, if they died at sea, they made sure they had a proper janaza. if monies were owed to them, Quillian would take the shipping company to the court to make sure that the money was sent back to the family in Somaliland or Bengal or wherever it was, and they weren't left.
And these people presumably came with no families, right? They were just the
same. They would have families back home.
Okay.
Yeah.
It
would be just be the men. But obviously, you in some parts, you would get the men intermarrying, particularly in places like South Shields, up in Tyne and Wear. You had a tradition of these Yemeni sailors marrying local women. And there was a very forward-looking sheikh, another great unknown hero, Sheikh Abdullahi Ali al-Hakimi, who educated these women, taught them the basics of Islam, and you know, I've got some fantastic pictures of some of the first madrasas with children in them that he used to run in the 1930s. You know,
was that very common for the people who were settled to marry the locals?
Well, it didn't happen everywhere. But mm-hmm. It happened much more then, back then, than maybe it would happen even now, if you see what I mean. Because
yeah. I mean,
the men were on their own, and you know, they were lonely, yeah. And you know, they, so.
I mean, it's interesting that these same problems of Britishness, as we kind of speak about it, we're still talking about this 100 years later, and it seems like some of these things about preserving community, those things, like we haven't moved past them yet, and yet.
Oh, I think things have changed. I don't think it's the same. We're not living in the same kind of the pressures that were on them then compared to what we have now were very great, you know. And this was the height of empire. You know, racial thinking was dominant. I'm going to give you an example. You know, I'll give you an example of the Yemeni sailors. The Yemeni sailors had, many of them had served during the First World War. As stokers, okay, so that meant these were steamships. They were shoveling coal into the engines to keep them going. That means they would spend days and days below decks, okay, for weeks below decks. It was dangerous, difficult, and dirty work. They're doing this under threat of bombing by the German U-boats, okay. They come off, they come out, and basically come back to Britain, come back to Cardiff, Swansea, South Shields, whatever. Then there were riots from demobbed soldiers who want to be re-employed as dockers, saying, we don't want these darkies with these jobs. We want these jobs. There were riots to keep them get them out of these jobs. So, I mean, it was an appalling set of, you know, racially driven riots. This is in 1919, the Milldam riots and in other places. It's one of those forgotten episodes. But these were after these men had served this country in the war. And done difficult and dirty and dangerous work, okay, for very little money. And many of them had lost their lives. And how did they get thanked? They got thanked by these rioting white demob soldiers who wanted their jobs back. You know, thank you very much. And so these, I'm not saying it was all dark. Obviously, there was intermarriage and, you know, but they were tough times, you know.
I guess maybe the impression we get from popular culture is, well, firstly, we mostly only see the white people. Even movies like Dunkirk, they only show the white faces in it. But even stories that we hear of Indians in Victoria are things like that movie Victoria and Abdul, where there was an Indian servant who came to serve Queen Victoria. Or even the stories we hear of people like Iqbal and Muhammad Ali Jinnah and Abdullah Yusuf Ali and all those people who came to London, they were members of the aristocracy. But those were very, very rare because they were Indians who made it to that level of financial success. And even then, maybe they were treated not as equal with their peers.
No, I mean, I think that you had this kind of, because Britain was the center of the world's largest empire at the time, it was a magnet for all the elites of the societies that they'd colonized. And at the crown of that was India. Okay. And so, you know, the Indian elite basically sent their talented children, mostly young men, obviously. There were some young women, but mostly young men, to study in London and other places in the law. And so another thing is, it's quite important because the people who are at the heart of the independence struggle in India were all pretty much educated in London.
Yeah.
And London, late 19th century London, early 20th century London, was a hotbed of anti-imperial struggles joining together and finding common cause against the British, including, you know, the Irish nationalist struggle. The Irish nationalists were linked to the Indian nationalists. Pan-Africanism was linked to pan-Islamism. Okay, there was a Dost Muhammad Ali who opened the first sort of black political journal in British history in London during the First World War. He worked with Quilliam when he'd retired to London. He linked together anti-imperial struggles from Asia to Africa. His journal was banned at least twice. You have the first seeds of pro-Palestinian activism in the middle of the First World War. Marmaduke Pickthall, the translator of the Quran, another Indian activist, worked to try and head off the Sykes-Picot Agreement from being signed. This was before a lot of the Arab world was actually aware of the Sykes-Picot Agreement. Yeah. So actually, this is the first real pro-Palestinian activism was done in London in the middle of the war by a few committed people who were aware of what was going on. So, you know, it's a very interesting, very exciting period where you had, there was pan-Islamism, unity amongst Muslim peoples, but they saw more broadly they had to link together in an international struggle against European colonialism. So you had people linking hands from all different sorts of backgrounds. And they were open to ideas from socialism. For instance, you know, the Russian Revolution had a big impact at the time. They were also open to nationalism. That was the currency of the age. They were thinking in terms of, you know, especially after the ending of the caliphate, they were thinking, well, how do we create independent nation states? Up until,
I mean, that's really interesting. Like, before I, like, you carry on, I've been thinking in my head while you were speaking, like, this is so interesting. That's why I've been really quiet. Is a lot of the stuff that you've said, I'm not even aware of, like, with there being Yemenis on the ships, especially since I'm from Somaliland. Like, I've never knew that, even though we were part of the British Empire, like, our people, or my people anyway, would have been part of being in Britain such in the early 19th century. Why is it then, do you think, that people may not be aware of the history in our current time? Or is it because that, you know, the history has been written by the victors, so therefore we no longer want to know about any other history? Like, why do you think that is?
I completely agree with you. We have to write our own histories, yeah, and we have to research those histories, and we have to educate our community and our people. And I don't just mean a kind of happy clappy British national integration story, okay? But all the sides of that history, good and bad, radical, yeah, left field or whatever, maverick kind of people that I'm interested in. To be honest, I'm interested in the rebels personally, the people who were, you know, activists who kind of pushed the establishment, you know, in one way or another. You know, we have a grand tradition of radical activism, for instance, in our Muslim history in this country, going back to the late 19th century. So I think we have to reclaim it. You know, we have to reclaim it. You know, things like things that we associate with Martin Luther King and the African civil rights movement, a lot of those methodologies were developed by anti-imperial struggles involving Muslims. Basically, in places like Iran and Asia, like the boycott, non-violent protest. It wasn't all Gandhi. The ulama were involved in these struggles right from day one.
Mm-hmm.
But we have a way of sort of writing that political history out. Constitutionalism was defended by the ulama in the early 20th century.
Yeah.
You'll probably know that as a lawyer. But, you know, this is really important. So boycotts, constitutionalism, strikes, some forms of direct action, not just petitions and things, you know, those sorts of things. So we had a kind of a civil rights, civil disobedience tradition in the anti-imperial struggle in the Muslim lands, which the ulama...
I'm going to ask a question before Thaqib jumps in. There is this discussion of the fact that as Muslims, we should be more peaceful. We should take the peaceful route when we are in doing activist work. And you've literally just said that we need to take more direct action. How can we then take direct action, which is in line with our Islamic principles and, you know, isn't deemed to be too radical, where it's like mate, what you're doing, come on, kind of thing, which you're always going to get regardless.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, all these techniques were pioneered by Muslim activists, you know, 100 years ago or more. They had the backing of the ulama. Now, of course, they were fighting for independence from European colonialism and imperialism. Okay. Here, people have, you know, basically, for the most part, we have refugee communities, but for the most part, historically, people moved here voluntarily. Okay. But the question I would have always is that the same can be said when we look at somebody like this American Civil Rights Movement or the Black Lives Matter movement now. People are using forms of civil disobedience to say that the system as it is structurally unfair to whole mm-hmm. groups of people, yeah, for one reason or another. You know, petitions, lobbying, you know, and these kinds of things haven't got anywhere. So I think, you know, there is room for some forms of direct action, so long as they are serving a higher moral purpose. If the law or the structure is wrong, obviously we don't want to harm people.
No.
Physically harm people. I'm not suggesting any form of violence, but I think we should reclaim radicalism mm-hmm. as a good thing in the age of prevent, which is trying to take all principled radicalism out of politics, out of protest politics. Okay, we need to have reclaim radical, returning to the fundamentals of the root in a positive sense, reclaim that history. And we've had a very kind of, how can I put it, a kind of quite a staid, quite a softly approach in Muslim student activism, in Muslim community activism, which is kind of, you know, it's the press release. It's
yeah, why the petition. Do you think that is?
Because we've always had two kinds of traditions in our community. We've got a kind of respectability politics, which is that basically you know, it's upwardly mobile, it's aspirational, it's middle class. Yeah. Let's have a photograph taken with the MP.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we get in with the powers that be and we can succeed.
One of the criticisms I've always had, or I've always heard from people who maybe didn't move across, is that look, the people who actually chose to move to the West from, you know, Muslim majority countries like Pakistan or parts of the Gulf or whatever, they're the people who went there for a better lifestyle. These are not the people who care, quote unquote. And sometimes I feel like that's very unfair. But do you think that the fact that we do so much respectability politics and everything's aspirational is because fundamentally most people moved to better kind of their lifestyle. Some of them as refugees because they had no option, but some of them just for economic migration. So
I just think we're in danger of having a cliched narrative about our own history. You know, one of the reasons why I wanted to recover this history is because we have a history of radical organizing that goes right through the 20th century, but we've forgotten mm-hmm. it. You know, anti-Palestinian radicalism involving Muslim students goes back 50, 60 years at least, with this early beginning in the First World War. Muslims organized with trade unions for many, many decades and were part of strikes and lockouts and sit-ins and so on.
So we
have a history. Anti-racism organizing has a 50-60 year history in our community, okay, including people got arrested and put their bodies on the line many, many times, you know, and so we have this history. We sometimes think that it's a different Muslim community that was involved in these things, but it wasn't. So it depends who are we writing out of our own story here. This is what I'm trying to. Now, the thing is that people say, well, that's secular socialism. We're involved with socialists and it was somehow another history. But the thing is, actually, these were still Muslims who were part of the community and were standing up for them and were linking hands on a shared cause. Mm-hmm. But they still went back and prayed namaz and make dua and eat halal meat and all of that
yeah.
at the end of the day.
Do you think there's a link between, or do you think there could be a link between like the respectable politics and being radical at the same time, where you're still sort of, you're playing the game as is, so you're trying to dismantle it while still trying to be the devil's advocate, if that makes any sense? Do you think that could be a possibility?
we have to be Allah and his prophet's advocate at all times, never shaitans. But no, I mean, the thing is that, in politics, there are many, there are always many possibilities. But what I'm trying to say is that we live in a community that has, because of the war on terror, because of the stigmatization of radical politics that's been going on for two decades now, and a very concerted pushback against our tradition of radical politics, not just amongst Muslims, but communities of color, working class communities, and so on.
Well, I guess haven't Sunni scholars always been, or this is the tradition, is that Sunni scholars have always been politically quietist, and we make change from positions of power, not from things like protests and things like that, which are ultimately always asking for change rather than actually being the change makers.
I think it just depends how you look at the history. Most of the three of the four imams of the legal schools were thrown into prison for dissent. I mean, you have to look very carefully again at the civil disobedience of the early scholars. Again, if we want to use a modern terminology, they were refused to cooperate with rulers, were put into jail. You know, they walk the walk. You know, they're the ones we revere, the ones who refuse to change their principles due to political expediency. So they weren't into the politics of respectability. They're into the politics of respect. Okay.
Do you think then
I was just going to ask, do
you think then now our ulama of current day are presenting that, or are they more taking what Thaqib said? Are they more just quietening the discourse and saying, look, listen, you need to not take part in politics and not take part in protests and just sort of pray in namaz and be quiet about it?
The ulama are not one, they don't have one opinion, as you know. So you'll always find ulama who will uphold this tradition of political organizing and dissent and activism and so on. And you'll find it in every community. It's not, you know, I mean, I'm from a Sufi background, but you have politically active Sufis, they're not all quietists. You have political active Salafis and you have quietist Salafis, blah, 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 mm-hmm. blah. Go through any community, you'll find there's an active wing and there's a quietist wing,
mm-hmm.
yeah, in any community. I don't think it's a theological issue per se, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
But one of the criticisms of, I guess, a lot of these organizations like MCB, but also more radical organizations, because is that actually these people have no practice in them, or there's no scholarly input. A lot of these people are making compromises that are completely antithetical to our religious values for the sake of worldly comfort. So in campaigning against Islamophobia, they'll make compromises that are completely unacceptable and go against our values.
What would be those compromises?
I think we said we'd probably come to this during the episode, is, for example, like with the recent BLM protest, most of the people who are involved in this, who have been more radical, they're very wary of working with BLM, for example. Because the impression is that BLM also supports LGBT rights, which we don't support as an organization. So where does that? But I guess my point fundamentally is that the impression one gets from looking at the radical Muslim circles at the moment is that it's not the scholars who are leading the charge; it's activists, some of whom have no religious backing at all.
Mm. Yes, I mean, I can see that quite often. I mean, one of the challenges at the moment is that the more vocal ulama seem to be articulating a kind of quietism and a precautious attitude. But some are going further than that and saying we have to be close to the powers that be. We have to ride the tiger of nationalism. We have to ride the tiger of the security state. We have to support prevent. Or we have to support national majority views, and often that will itself lead to some really damaging policies against Muslim communities, encouraging Islamophobia, encouraging the spread of prevent, and openly supporting these policies, supporting the states that suppress their own political activists or suppress Muslim minorities abroad. Okay, turning a blind eye to these problems. And turning a blind eye to civil liberties. So it's not that choice has political costs too. It's not a pain-free choice, that one. I agree that the articulation of what I'm talking about amongst ulamas at the present time is relatively weak, and that has to be worked on. I'd be first to admit that. But when it comes to community organizations, including your parent organizations, you know, they have worked, you know, Muslim communities in this country have voted Labour for decades. Okay, it's a Labour voting community. In that time, the Labour Party has gone from being socially conservative to socially liberal or progressive. Okay, in all those decades. And now, really, for the first time in British politics in the last 20 years, when it comes to things like sexual orientation, all of the main political parties basically hold the same view, whether it's Liberal Democrats, Greens, the Conservatives even. Okay, so in that, maybe 20 years ago, you could have said that, well, you know, if sexual orientation is the key issue for you as a voter, you better vote Tory. The Muslim community never did that. It still voted Labour. The only time,
I guess, the other question is: should that have been the key issue for Muslim voters? Because there's a lot of other things like economics and things like that.
Has it ever been the key issue for Muslim voters? That's what I'm saying to you. Has it ever been the key issue? The other thing is that, you know, even not even talking about people who vote or people who join political parties, but you know. You know, the MAB were integral to the anti-war movement nearly 20 years ago. They helped set up the Respect Party. The Respect Party had a pro-LGBTQ rights on its founding statement, with a proviso that at the time, you can go and look it up, that, you know, they will respect people's right to differ and hold their own, adhere to their religious values. Yeah. They would be forced to actively campaign for any of those positions. So they figured it out 20 years ago. There's no reason why one can't figure it out now. You know, if they're willing to do that with a bunch of white socialists, why can't they do it with black socialists and BLM now?
Yeah. Do you think that's the key issue, that at the time it was an alliance with white socialists and now it's an alliance with black people?
I don't know, but I'm being provocative to get people to stop being lazy and making arguments that they didn't make in 2004 when they were forming the Respect Party. I'm being very sharp and pointed to get them to think very hard about what's motivating this objection, because it wasn't an objection 20 years ago. Do you see what I'm saying? I am being provocative, but I'm being provocative with a purpose. Yeah, is to get people to really think, is there some anti-blackness going on here, which is unexpressed, is behind the scenes? And if they deny it and say no, I say fine. Then why is this an issue now when it wasn't an issue 20 years ago? Jeremy Corbyn, you know, these activist groups have really supported Jeremy Corbyn, okay? And he's never had an anti-LGBT platform, ever.
Yeah.
Okay. The Black Lives Matter movement, they're the only major movement of at the moment pushing the Palestinian cause in Britain.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think
they're the only major force now outside of the Muslim community challenging Prevent. So they're already sort of saying, look, we see all these issues are connected. Okay. The thing is, you have to walk into anything with your eyes open. Stand, you know, don't go in without an agenda. Don't go in with your eyes closed. You know, have an agenda. You know, work on issues of justice that you share in common. You don't have to sign up to the whole platform.
So what agenda?
Do you see what I mean?
The
question is, what kind of society do you want to live in? Do you want to live in a society that's becoming more racialized, or do you want to, you know, be part of an anti-racism movement for the big difference now between now and the 1970s is Muslims didn't exist politically in the 1970s in this country. Now Black Lives Matter are saying Muslim lives matter. They're saying Muslim lives matter. 20 years after the war on terror, where Muslim lives haven't mattered, where we've been blown out of existence, bombed in umpteen countries around the world, okay, and Muslim lives are degraded. So we have to ask, this is a really big moment. Are we going to say to young Generation Z Muslims, like my daughter who's 17, who is really caught up being politicized by Black Lives Matter herself, you know, am I going to say to her, to my daughter, that the biggest mobilization of young people on anti-racism grounds at our community should sit it out? Is that really what we're saying?
Mm.
You know, that for me is madness. It's timidity. It's lack of vision. It's a lack of thinking. Okay. Now I'm not saying walk into anything with your eyes closed and don't have a plan, don't have a strategy, and don't be wise and be strong. You know, you can't go into anything going to say yes to everything. Yeah. That's just not how it works. But, you know, we've been used to kind of holding the begging bowl to the government and saying, you know, please give us a seat at the table and recognize us and be nice to us. There's been a lack of political confidence in previous generations of activists. But now we need to recover our moral courage and our bravery, yeah, and have a program. The biggest problem we have is we don't have a program. What does our Muslim community need? Okay, what do we need? I mean, I can suggest things that I think that we need. Okay, but I'm sure you would know what they are too. We need, you know, we've got a lot of poor kids. We've got a lot of problems with prevent. Okay, we've got a lot of problems with poor health, poor housing. You name it, we've got policing issues. You know, once you identify the core issues affecting our community, then you can set a program to address that. I'm the moderate Muslim. Accept me at the table.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm respectable. You can deal with me, and then we'll
deal
with
the initiative.
We'll deal with the extremism problem for you. That's what we've been, you know, too much. We've been saying that kind of thing.
Do you think this problem registers at all? So, for example, like one thing that I think Muslims have been definitely silent on is NHS, right? Privatization of NHS is happening piece by piece. Affects Muslims disproportionately because we tend to be primarily BAME communities, primarily from backgrounds where we need healthcare. And just like everyone else, but the reality is some of us come from poor backgrounds, and we would really struggle if it was a private insurance world or even a nationalized insurance world where your healthcare would be checked at the point of care or something. And yet Muslims seem strangely quiet on this, where we're talking about things happening in other areas or which, again, I'm not denying are important, but things happening in foreign countries ultimately are. If we as a community aren't successful, how are we going to do all the fundraising and all the support we do to other countries?
I think to add on to that is we are very outward looking in terms of international struggles, but we're not very inward looking in what's going on in our own backyard. There are some initiatives and there are a lot of community organizations and other organizations that do work with British sort of problems. But we don't actually, as a community, as an entirety, fundraise for things that are actually happening to us here. If that makes any sense? So why do you think?
Yeah, I mean, the vast majority of money that we fundraise goes abroad.
Yeah,
the vast majority of it. But you know, I have to go back to Malcolm X. You know, that he always connected. He internationalized his struggle. So he said to the Arabs, the Muslim world, and he said to Africa, he said, take up the cause of black Muslims. It's not a civil rights issue. It's a human rights issue. He was going to take it to the UN. So he mm-hmm. internationalized his domestic politics. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So we're sort of saying, no, hang on. International politics is a distraction from domestic politics. That's what we're saying.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, we should be saying, can we internationalize our domestic politics?
To make it
and at the same, at the
so you kind of combine the both.
And at the same yeah. time, no, you link them to further the end of that, of each, if that makes sense. So,
yeah.
You know, why is it that we've always said that, why did Nelson Mandela say that the South Africans are never truly free until Palestine is free? Why did he link his freedom
with
to
the
freedom of the Palestinians? Why? I'm asking you why. Why did he link them?
Because there is a commonality in terms of like what was going on in the two places.
Well, if freedom can be crushed anywhere, somewhere else, it could be crushed anywhere, right?
Mm-hmm.
If colonialism is an evil, it can't be okay in one place
and not
in another. And it's that dichotomy of thinking that we're being the whole time. If we don't stand for internationalism and linking up, this is the big lesson of the late 19th, early 20th century. Why did anti-imperialism succeed? Because I was talking to you earlier, you know, it was connect your causes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Why did you have Muslims in London working with Africans, working with Asians? Why did you have Indians working with, you know, with converts? Why were they working on all these causes at the same time and linking them?
Because they realized that together they... That connectivity.
We haven't lost anything. We have to make it happen. It starts with us.
Okay.
It just starts with our. But we have to a focus on not on identity politics, but on alliance building. Mm-hmm. You have to face outwards on a common cause, and that common cause is a greater freedom in your society and a greater freedom around the world, and justice in a broad sense. Okay. Mm-hmm. We have to find ways to connect. You know, now for Muslims, this is very complicated. We've been split up into nation states for nearly a century. And so nationalist thinking has come to predominate in our political imagination. And we can't sort of think outside of it. But it's important that when we're located in Britain and in the British Muslim communities is a multinational community coming into one community, right? So we have so many connections around the world. We can make a virtue out of that to have a broader vision, a connected vision, articulate a different kind of politics. And I think that's what's really important. And we can draw inspiration from this earlier actors from 100 years ago who was facing, you know, a similar set of political dynamics, shall we say.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting you've reframed the history from almost, you know, nearly 140 years, because usually when we talk about activism in this country, we speak about like the 90s as this golden age where Muslims in this country campaigned against the Bosnia War or the Bosnian genocide, actually, and that's what we should call it. But even, Muslims were a lot more active. We did the Million Man March 16, 20 years ago, and we've never been able to mobilize quite like that ever again. Whereas I think what you're saying is actually a long time ago could have been the golden age of activism.
I'm not saying there's a golden age. I think that there are moments when we come together and we get it, and it's always possible. There's no like false declinism here. We have to make it happen in our generation. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
So when you see that people suddenly connecting, coming together, you know, the thing is, you think, is it a worthy cause? Do I want to live in a less racist society? You know, after Brexit, after clampdown on immigrants, the fact that refugees die every day trying to get into Europe, many Muslims and people of color, that is an issue that Black Lives Matter campaigned on. It's an issue we should be campaigning on much more vociferously. Many of those people are Muslims who are dying in boats in the Mediterranean.
Do you see that?
Why aren't we campaigning on that? You know, I don't understand that our activism is so lethargic. Honestly, our priorities are all wrong.
Well, for a lot of people, their argument is actually we can campaign for this without campaigning or without standing with BLM or without standing with an organization where you feel like you have to compromise on things. Because ultimately, if you're out in the public sphere, and we've seen examples of Muslims in the West who come out in the public sphere, and nearly all of them end up succumbing to statements that are either kind of less than ideal or you feel like they've just sold out completely.
You have to go into anything in life
with an
prepared with an agenda, with a program. If you go in without an agenda or program, you're done for in anything in life. So it requires a certain political maturity and wisdom. But you know, this is what we inside our community, we should always be discussing things all the time between generations, between different activist groups. Everybody's in their little bubbles, you know, social media bubbles. They're not talking. We're not passing on and sharing experiences, comparing notes, etc. You can have so much of a conversation with people from anywhere. I mean, in preparation for this program, I talked to somebody inside BLM. I asked them what it's like, how do they treat Muslims, how do they deal with all these issues that you're discussing, what's their attitude?
And what was their attitude?
They're not really interested in your personal values. All they're interested in is if you're joining on certain campaigns or not. There isn't going to be some ideological litmus test about your homophobia if you join in with the group. You know, you have to make sure that you're clear about where you stand and what you can do and can't do. So that we have to think about our own ethical standards, our own practices of solidarity and tarbiyah and how we reform. You know, I think the Black Lives Matter, what's really interesting about them is that they went through a lot of this kind of psychoanalyzing stuff about 5 years ago and realized it was stopping them. All this checking of people was stopping them building an alliance. Now, they're very critical on race issues and how people present or don't present, but it doesn't stop them building the alliance around issues. And that's their focus now. The focus is out into mm-hmm. society, making changes. The homework, the work you take home that you do on yourself, you don't bring it out to your activism to get in the way. I don't need to give you my white trauma. I don't need you to psychoanalyze me. Yeah, I have to do that homework. There has to be some education.
Do you think we do too much of that as a Muslim community by like checking people and sort of proclaiming that they can't take part in certain things because they themselves haven't been fully formed?
So you can't join this organization because you're not a hijabi or your beard isn't long enough for that kind of thing.
Or you ain't wearing a
thong. Oh, I think that's rife, you know. Because it's about it's about a competitive economy of competing for membership for more members between mm-hmm. different groups. So then what you say is that, well, you know, if you adhere to our program of tarbiyah, our understanding of the deen, you know, and you have to say the other guys down the road are awful, or the other guys with the other ISOC or whatever. But if you face outwards in a shared campaign where you agree on the goals, then you can build solidarities. Yeah, we need intra-Muslim solidarities just as much as we need anti-racism solidarities. So we need to be about building, as the Prophet said, Hifz al-Fudul, you know, an alliance of virtue. Okay, and we need to be about that. You know, the early 20th century anti-imperial struggle was amongst Muslims was vehemently anti-sectarian. So people joined from Sunni, Shia, didn't matter. They were all part of the anti-imperial struggle. There were no distinctions made. It was a moment of anti-sectarianism as well. Yeah. So we need to, as I said, we need to know our own history of political organizing. We can't be naive. You know, I'm here to offer my services if you want me to do any classes or anything like that. Amongst the activists.
I think this kind of, I know we need to wrap up.
We need to wrap up, but I'm saying to you, we need to have this education of our activist class so that our imaginations are not stuck in a certain train track thinking or group thinking that this is the way it has to be done because somebody's, you know, always done it that we think somebody's always done it that way, you know?
So I guess when you talk about educating yourself and doing the homework, so what resources would you recommend for tarbiyah or personal development for our listeners and viewers now to take away and do? Do you recommend any books or content or anything that people can make a start on?
That's a really broad question. So I'm going to give you a general answer, which is that I think it's important to realize that we have a vast civilization, a vast legacy of thought within Islam. So all I would say is that is always wider than the tarbiyah program of any particular group that we've joined. The deen is vaster than the tarbiyah program of any particular group that we've joined. Okay, your journey to Allah through your life is bigger and vaster and more important than the tarbiyah program of any particular group that you've joined. The group is not the end in and of itself. The group is a means to some Islamic end. Okay? So to never connect your personal journey of salvation and never connect your struggle for justice entirely with the aim within the aims of one program. Yeah. Be a maverick in that way. Okay? But always come together and work together for common good with your students. Be organized and come together. Yeah. But you don't, the work that you do at uni as students, it doesn't have to define your whole journey as a Muslim. It's just part of the journey that you're on. That's all I'm saying. You know, it's not for me to tell you where to end up. You're intelligent, you're committed, you'll find the sources, you know. But I'll tell you about solidarity and alliance building. You know, one good book which was part of the tarbiyah program of the movement that I've always loved is The Duties of Brotherhood by Imam Ghazali, which is on I think is on the syllabus of the UKM group still, as far as I know. I don't know about MAB, But, you know, that is a classic, you know. And if you want to kind of have a way of checking people that isn't in your face and unduly confrontational, you see, because call-out culture, this is the thing. I mean, with call-out culture, the thing is sometimes the aim could be to humiliate somebody. But in humiliating them, you arouse their nuffs, you know, their ego. And instead of actually taking what you say on board to heart and actually changing, they become enraged and they reject what you're saying, even though it's true and right. And sometimes some tact and some wisdom, pulling someone aside and saying it quietly to them, is going to be more effective than, you know, fronting everything and making them feel small and humiliating them, you know. Of course, there are times when you have to stand up to bullies, but that's for you to judge. Ask Allah to guide you, to give you the wisdom to judge each case, thing, case by case, you know.
I mean, I think that's a very kind of strong point to end on, as well as the book recommendation. We really appreciate your time coming in and discussing this with us. We really hope to have you on. I think we can go on a whole tangent about the history aspect and go into a deep dive into that. So hopefully we'll do. From all of us at the Middle West Podcast, thank you very much. Listeners can email us at podcast@themiddlewest.co.uk. Interact with us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, @TheMiddleWestPC, and @TheMiddleWestPodcast on Instagram. And we hope to see you next in the next 2 weeks with another episode of the Middle West Podcast. Thank you very much. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.